May it please the court, counsel, John Evenson, and I represent the DeForest Redevelopment Authority. I'm Ted Wiskowski. This is a case about reliance damages. It's a case about reliance damages that were not proven. What Mr. Levin did here is he added up all of the hours that he says that his staff worked, multiplied it by what he claimed his retail billing rate was, took that answer, then subtracted how much the DRA had paid him, and when he got that answer, he said, I want to be paid that much money. He claims that those are his reliance damages. He says that this hoped-for income are his expenditures. Obviously, they are not expenditures. The district court recognized this and did not fine for him on an expenditure theory when it came back. Instead, the district court said, well, if Mr. Levin hadn't spent this time on this project, he would have been able to build this to someone else, and he determined, well, he couldn't have billed it all to someone else in all probability, but I think he could have billed $450,000 to someone else. The problem with this is that there was absolutely no evidence of a lost opportunity in this case. There was no evidence whatsoever that any specific project even existed. There was no specific evidence that Mr. Levin would have been retained by anyone for another project. And there was no specific evidence as to how much money any other project would have produced to him. There is absolutely no basis to support a lost opportunity theory award here. The plaintiff seems to recognize that. At page 12 and 13 of their brief, they deny that the district court based its award on a lost opportunity theory. They say the district court's memoranda and order plainly reflect that it was not proceeding under the lost opportunity theory. The best argument that we can make in response to that, Your Honors, is to ask you to read the opinion on pages 3, 4, and 5. Clearly, that's what Judge Chabas did. We believe that this position taken by the plaintiff indicates that they realize that the award cannot be sustained on a lost opportunity theory, and so they claim that they have proven the cost actually incurred. There is no evidence of that.
When you say cost under a reliance?
Under reliance, on expenditures, out-of-pocket costs.
So is there a way to come up with a formula based on what the district court did that might come out with somewhat the same result if it were, say, this is what we had to, this is what it cost us. We paid X people this amount of money to work, and we had these expenses and doing this and that. And I guess what it doesn't include is what it, your overhead to run your office or something, right?
That is precisely what was required to prove the case, but that is also precisely what the plaintiff did not include in any proof. There is absolutely no proof in the record as to what any of these people were made, what they were paid. There's absolutely no proof in the record as to what benefits went along with the salary. There is absolutely no proof in the record as to what variable expenses could have been saved if the work had not been done. Absolutely none, Your Honor. And that is the problem. Instead, they did a calculation of what they hoped their income would be. And that is the precise problem in the case. And that's why the award cannot be sustained. And that's why on the record in front of you, and the record that has been made, a further award cannot be made, and so we respectfully suggest that your decision here should dismiss the case. All the amounts that have been paid, all of the damages that have been awarded, have been paid. It's over. It cannot be proven. It cannot be saved. Now, that's not a harsh result by any means, because the shortcomings in the damages claims were made early and often by us. Judge Chabas called the damages fanciful in his original opinion before the first appeal, when you remanded it back for a further proceedings, there's no evidence in the record that the plaintiff asked for an opportunity to put in competent proof, and there simply wasn't done. That's the problem. The problem is they did not prove expenses.
You say you can't remand this with further directions in them.
There is no evidence in the record from which a competent award could be made.
I guess if we say that, would it be proper to remand it again to say, here's what you didn't do and you got to do this?
Well, we would object to that, Your Honor, on the basis that the plaintiffs have had two opportunities to put in competent.
Well, I'm not asking to jump in and approve the ID. You just want to know whether you thought it was legally possible.
I assume it is, Your Honor. I have no authority that it is not. But what I think we're going to hear from the plaintiff is that, well, I told you what my hope for billing rate is. I picked a profit number out of the air. If you take the profit and take that off of my claim billing rate, well, then you get something close to cost. Well, that is clearly not proof to a reasonable certainty. And the fatal flaw is, I mean, it's as simple as we're standing here now. If you don't do this case, this building is going to be here. People are going to be paid anyway. The electricity will have to be paid for, and so forth. And and that's what they failed to do. They failed to say what specific expenditures were made for this project. That they did not do. Now,
could they have had a valid claim if they chose to go for the lost opportunity value?
Well, they at trial.
Obviously, they had to bring in a lot of evidence, but would that be a viable alternative?
That would have been a viable alternative. And actually, at trial, Your Honor, they flopped back and forth. They put in some expenditures, and they did try to put in some proof of lost opportunity. And we believe all of the lost opportunity proof that they tried to put in was quoted in our brief, and it utterly failed to prove a lost opportunity. Our point being, they had an opportunity to do that. They made sort of a semi-attempt to prove it, and they did not come close. I'll save the rest of my time.
Right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Westcastle. Mr. Siebel?
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Greg Seibel. I represent plaintiff appellee, Designer Direct, as well as the counter defendant appellee. And I'm going to depart from my script right away. On the one hand, the DRA says, gee, you should have proven your case by lost opportunity. And the way you do that is you go and you establish that. You could have gotten a contract with A, B, and C customer and prove what you would have made on that contract. And in fact, in their brief, I think it's at page 12, they allege that there's four elements that you have to prove. Number four is the amount it would have been paid for the project. That's what we proved. We proved the amount that we should be paid for the work that we did, not for some other project, admittedly, but for the work that we actually did in this contract. There's no meaningful distinction that would say that you can prove what you would have made on a third-party contract, and that's reasonable enough, that's reasonable certainty, but it's not reasonable certainty if you prove it with respect to actual work that was done on this particular contract. It doesn't make any sense. So, the lost opportunity theory, just briefly, counsel is suggesting that the only way that we could prove our damages either is through out-of-pocket expenses and a lost opportunity theory. And in order to prove a lost opportunity theory, we have to show contracts that would have been entered into with third parties. I think this court has already dealt with that issue in its first decision. The court said my client is entitled to reliance damages. It's entitled to reliance damages for the actual work that it did in actual preparation for phase three of this contract, because this was a long-term undertaking, it was a joint venture, and Levin Associates couldn't sit and do nothing while phase one and phase two were going on, because everybody would have been behind the eight ball. It had to, as an obligation under the contract, prepare for phase three. It did. The DRA breached the contract, and my client is entitled to damages. Now,
is the legal definition of reliance damages, does that fit into what you want to get, or does there have to be some sort of a subtraction of things other than what you actually expended for the project in preparation for it?
And that's exactly what I was going to get to, Judge, and I think that's the only significant issue in this case. Once you get past the lost opportunity, which is all that was really argued in the appellant's first brief, and then in our reply brief we say, look, they haven't argued that we haven't properly established our damages. Suddenly in the reply brief they say, oh yeah, you have to do it by out-of-pocket expenses. But I would submit to the court that that's not the case. Basically, what counsel is saying is the only way you can arrive at the number 9 is by adding 4 plus 3 plus 2. And I don't mean to trivialize this or in any way. But the fact of the matter is you can get to 9 by proving 10 minus 1. So in other words, what they want the court to accept is the only way that we can prove our damages is establish the wages that would have been paid to these employees, establish the hours that these employees worked on this project, allocate the amount of benefits attributable to this project that each of these employees who worked on this project benefited from, allocate the variable overhead that would be applicable to this project, allocate fixed overhead that would be applicable to this project, add it all up, and get to 9. That's the only way you can do it. I submit to the court that that is not the only way you can do it. You can do it the other way. You can say, what is the reasonable fee that we could charge for the actual hours that were performed, calculate the total amount based upon that, and you have your total fee. Now, granted, there's profit included in that. And before I digress further, the contract specifically said, the phase one contract, the parties specifically agreed to hourly rates for various employees. In the phase two and three contract, they adopted those same rates. So there's no question that the rates are reasonable. What we have then is, and also, we have the hours, and Mr. Levin was qualified as an expert, and he calculated the hours and allocated them between phase one, phase two, phase three by employee. We know the exact hours that were allocated to phase three. We know the hourly rates for those employees, so we arrive at a total number of $494,000. Now, there's a profit component to that because it's an hourly rate. And the restatement says in reliance damages, you don't get profit. That's the significant distinction between your expectation interest and your reliance interest. So what we did was we proved the total amount, and Mr. Levin, as an expert, testified that between 6 and 15% of the amount is profit, and on average, it is 10%. We subtracted that amount from the total amount, and you arrive at costs. Now, what costs do they include? It includes the overhead. It includes the wages. It includes the benefits. We just got to 9 by subtracting 1 from 10 instead of adding 4 plus 3 plus 2. Is there support for this in the circuit? Yes. The support is the Autotrol decision in 1990 that was authored by Judge Posner. And now the court doesn't say you can subtract 1 from 10 or you can add 4 plus 3 plus 2. But what the court does say is that the expenses that you're entitled to include, in circumstances where you have a company that's clearly growing, they include all of the overhead, fixed overhead, variable overhead, wages, everything. There is no suggestion anywhere in the record that there is any element or expense that my client would not be entitled to that should be subtracted from the net amount of total minus profit. And I'd like to address the Autotrol decision because it was cited by us in the first appeal of this case, and then it was cited for the first time by the DRA in their reply brief in this case. And Judge Posner, he talks about, well, you can analyze things in terms of fixed costs and variable costs for purposes of determining whether overhead is appropriate. And he says, but this analysis is superficial. And he goes on to explain why it is. And then he says, now, really, as long as there's a company is in a growth mode, you include fixed overhead and variable overhead. And he says, so as a practical matter, we could just simply say, let's make a blanket rule that if a company is a growth company, then you get your variable overhead and your fixed overhead. He said, but we don't really need to do that. We don't need to answer that question. And he says at page...
You want to have an answer to it anyway, don't you?
I'm sorry?
You want to have an answer to it anyway, even if you don't have to. That's
Yeah, exactly. And what he said is, it is enough that a reasonable jury could conclude Autotrol probably would have recouped its overhead expenses on other projects had the contract with Continental never been signed, instead of wasting a year of its employees' time on this barren contract. That is, in essence, what the judge did, the district court judge did in this case. He reasonably concluded that Levin Associates probably would have recovered those expenses had it worked on another project. That's all that was required. It was reasonable certainty, and it is sustainable. And the standard here is clear error, as this court recognized in its first decision. Judge Posner also went on to address the issue of overhead expenses a little bit further, and I apologize for reading, but obviously I couldn't address this because it was first addressed in the reply brief. But Judge Posner goes on to say, if the plaintiff can either cut his overhead expenses or recover them in a substitute contract, then he indeed has not lost them as a result of the breach, and they should not be figured into his damages. But if he can do either of these things, if in other words these really are fixed costs, then the breach gives him no scope to economize, and there should be no deduction. The breach in this case, of course, occurred after the overhead expenses were incurred. This sequence meant that the breach, far from enabling those expenses to be covered in a substitute contract, converted them from a bookkeeping entry into a loss. Again, that's what happened here. The breach was after the expenses were incurred. It wasn't just a bookkeeping entry, it was a loss. And we're entitled to, my client is entitled to all of those expenses. Now, the fact that it took the simple way to get there doesn't mean that it wasn't reasonable. It's still reasonably certain, and the court found that. The court said that the hourly rates in the contract are powerful evidence that these are reasonable amounts. That's the argument, judges, and I appreciate your time, and I ask you to affirm this case.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Sebo. Mr. Maskowski.
A couple of responses. First, plaintiff can prove his damages any way he wants to. It's his choice. He made the choice. But if, having made the choice, he needs to bring competent proof before the court that can allow a verdict on a reasonable certainty basis. He didn't do that here. The argument that, well, he came close enough that there were no fixed costs, as if the business suddenly appeared out of nowhere, did this project, and would have disappeared. If you want to say, look, I would have had the same cost, and I would have lost them anyway because I would have had another job, then you need proof of the other job, which there clearly was not. You go in a circle. If you want to show, do a sort of a combination of out-of-pocket expenses and lost opportunity, then you have to prove the expenses and the lost opportunity, and he didn't do either one. He said he proved his expenses. There's no evidence of any expenses proven. He says you just take my fictional billing rate or retail billing rate and you subtract the profit. What is your profit? Well, I believe the profit would have been about 10% in this case. There's a Seventh Circuit case, the Jones case cited in our brief, that says you absolutely can't do this. You can't simply pick a number out of the air without more. You can't simply say it's 10%. Because he could have said it's 10%, it's 20%, it's 50%, or 70%, and no matter what he would have said on this record, the decision maker, the fact finder, wouldn't have had any basis to do one over another. It simply can't be done. There is no evidence to support this award. There is none. It could have been done right now. The last point I'd like to make is simply this, that this is not a case where the breach makes the proof more difficult. How much you pay your people, what the benefits are, and all of that are things that you're required by federal law to know so you can pay your taxes and comply with the laws and so forth. He had this evidence. He had to have this evidence. He chose, obviously, not to bring it to the court on purpose for his own purposes, presumably because he hoped he would get a bigger award, and that's not appropriate. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.